welcome to Jerry Roach's podcasts. Continuing with Northern Heights, climbing North America's highest peaks, we are ready for the conclusion of Chapter 7, History Squared, Mount Blackburn, 1977. Here we go. Jelly beans. After our huge crux effort, we luxuriated in our extra space. However, June 15 was a beautiful clear day, and we had to keep moving. Leaving at 1:30 p.m., Rob, myself, Roger, and Hinkle led ahead, while Barb stayed in camp to carefully inventory our dwindling food supply. Looking back at the double cornice now below us helped my mind catch up with my body. Above us was a small 15,430-foot summit that we just called the 15er, and beyond that, we hoped for easier slopes leading up to the East Peak and the summit plateau. The four of us carried our loads up 800 feet to a flat area just below the steep slopes leading up to the 15er. After caching, Hinkle continued his non-stop naming by proclaiming this place the Perch. We hoped to only make one alpine-style climb above the perch, so to cycle our clock back to a saner day, we returned to the rest home to prepare our summit push. We were nearing the longest days of the year, and that evening the sun still beamed on the peaks to the east. I saw 16,550-foot Mount Bona near the Alaska-Yukon border. Then my neck's hair sprang to attention when I recognized the immense bulk of mighty Mount Logan in the distance. Barb and I had climbed Logan, Canada's highest peak, in 1973 as part of our year-long Climb Around the World Odyssey. I called Barb out for the view, and together we quietly ogled the surreal scene. Moments like this speak better of Alaska than fancy moves on a ridge, but it was our movement that had put us into this picture. Back in our rest home tents, Roger continued our expansive mood by reciting from memory the famous Robert Service poem, The Land That God Forgot. The lonely sunsets flare forlorn, down valleys dreadly desolate. The lordly mountains soar in scorn, as still as death, as stern as fate. The lonely sunsets flame and die, the giant valleys gulp the night. The monster mountains scrape the sky, where eager stars are diamond bright. So gaunt against the gibbous moon, piercing the silence velvet piled, a lone wolf howls his ancient rune, the fell arch spirit of the wild. O outcast land, O leper land, let the lone wolf cry all express the hate insensate of thy hand, thy heart's abysmal loneliness. Inspired, we chatted for another hour as the late northern light slowly transitioned toward the new day. Finally, hoping for summit-skipping dreams, we lay back for sleep. Nature neatly disposed our summit dash on June 16. Increasing night winds dispersed our dreams, and a serious storm kept us in the tents all day. At least we were in the rest home and not still struggling over the snave. However, with the snave, double cornice, zipper, and ripper behind us, our commitment to the traverse was even deeper. We started eating leftovers, reading, and playing hearts. The only difference on June 17 was that there was less wind, but more snow. There were also less leftovers. However, it seemed like the storm was on the move, which meant that it would clear eventually. Amazingly, in our most exposed position, we had lost 2 complete days. At 6 a.m. on June 18, an impatient Rob announced sternly that, make or break, this was summit day. It was indeed time to run for the summit, make the traverse, and get down the northwest ridge before the next storm had time to form and trap us high on the mountain. However, the current storm was not really over. Nevertheless, we packed our beloved rest home camp and started up into a whiteout at 9:30 a.m. I led into the whiteout, unable to see our previous steps or the next wand. Stepping slowly, I employed all 10 senses and found our cache at the perch. Further effort was futile, and happy to be reconnected with our remaining food, we pitched our tents. Thus, the perch became our 9th camp, which was many more than we had planned. Would we need more camps than a cat has lives? We were up early on June 19 and again prepared for our summit climb. The weather improved at 9 a.m., and after packing everything, we started climbing at 11:30 a.m. We had our entire kit on our backs now, and there would be no more relays. Our first task was to climb the two-summited 15er. On first inspection, it looked rather intimidating. It held a steep avalanche slope and a huge crevasse that extended from near camp all the way across the east face of the east peak. Fortunately, there was one place where we could cross the barrier and regain the ridge. We made steady but slow progress with our now heavy packs and knee to mid-thigh deep snow. We crossed the barrier crevasse without incident, but kept the ropes tight between us. The hours slipped by as I crept up to the first summit of the 15er. Then Rob led on to the 15er's higher northern summit that Hinkle couldn't resist naming the Sneak. That was our last landmark before we could begin our dash to, then across, the summit plateau. Compared to the Snave, the Sneak was a minor summit, and we quickly moved down to the small saddle beyond it. After more than a week spent on precipitous terrain, the ridge ahead, while flanked by steep slopes, looked much gentler, and we prepared to move out. The East Peak was now only a mile away and less than 1,000 feet above us. We hoped to be there in a couple of hours. However, we had a problem. The sky was now white. Barb best captured our struggles on this epic day when she wrote these cryptic notes in her diary. RB leads up ridge with beautiful view off south face down Kuskalana and beyond its icefalls to Nugget Creek. A narrow sidewalk. GR leads over 15er number 1, wades 100 yards, and stop for snowshoes. Tromp to top of official 15er, later to be seen as Cornice, and down other side. Slide for BR. Next obstacle, steep double cornice, time for crampons. Plow through 3 feet of snow, change to snowshoes. Weather socking in. RB struggles for 1 hour to gain 100 yards. Deep snow, white out at a bowl, and camp is pitched. 5 and tent, warm and snug. Beautiful night, sun and shadow of peak, cold, mackerel clouds above. As we pressed on into the gathering gloom and snow, we had a hard time believing that the weather was really crapping out on our summit push, so we kept climbing. Finally, nearing 15,600 feet, we were in a blinding whiteout and had to stop. Still believing that this was just a squall, we pitched one of our tents in a small scoop in the exposed ridge that was big enough for one tent, but not two, and all dove in for shelter. If someone had told us how long we would be here, we would have screamed. After only a few hours of rest in our comfortable perch, we were back in a cramped camp a few feet from steep slopes. This camp, however, was nearly on the summit plateau and exposed to the west wind, which intensified as the northern night slowly closed in on us. Never mind, it would clear in the morning. Day 1, June 20, began in a snowstorm. Not just a view-stealing fog, this was a deep storm, and we had no choice but to hunker down. This was the worst weather so far on the trip, and it was certainly close to a worst-case scenario for us. We examined our food supply and were dismayed to find that we only had 2 days of food left. Sensing that the Grinch had us, we immediately cut our intake back to 1/3 rations. We spent the day resting and chatting, but every time I went out of the tent, the storm's ferocity and our exposed position were excessively evident. This was the day that I was supposed to be back at my desk, and I wasn't sure that my smart boss was going to believe this improbable story. Day two began with a blizzard, and we cut back to quarter rations. Having all five of us in a single tent that was designed for four was convenient because it was easy to communicate, but we were cramped. Our conversation was much more animated today, and Hinkle, our master of names, proclaimed this camp to be the last gasp. We had tossed all our books, but Barb produced a small deck of cards from the bottom of her pack, and we relaunched our open-ended hearts tournament. Day three began with a blizzard. Today, we basically stopped eating and hamstered away a sacred stash of calories that we knew we would need to get over the summit. We allowed ourselves five jelly beans for the day, one per person. It was up to each individual to decide how and when to eat their meal. In the afternoon, Roger entertained us with the Robert Service poem, "The Men That Don't Fit In." There's a race of men that don't fit in, a race that can't stay still. So they break the hearts of kith and kin, and they roam the world at will. They range the field and they rove the flood, and they climb the mountain's crest. Theirs is the curse of the gypsy blood, and they don't know how to rest. I interrupted Roger after the second stanza with a hearty, "Yeehaw! This is great! This is us!" Roger quickly countered with, "Slow down, cowboy. Don't be too impressed with yourself. There's a lot more." Barb twitched but said nothing. Roger continued with a stern tone. "If they just went straight, they might go far. They are strong and brave and true. But they're always tired of the things that are, and they want the strange and new. They say, 'Could I find my proper groove? What a deep mark I would make.' So they chop and change, and each fresh move is only a fresh mistake." Roger paused for dramatic effect, gave me an accusatory eye, raised his voice over the storm, and continued, "And each forgets as he strips and runs with a brilliant, fitful pace. It's the steady, quiet, plodding ones who win in the lifelong race. And each forgets that his youth has fled, forgets that his prime is past, till he stands one day with a hope that's dead in the glare of the truth at last. He has failed, he has failed, he has missed his chance, he has just done things by half. Life's been a jolly good joke on him, and now is the time to laugh. Ha ha! He is one of the legion lost. He was never meant to win. He's a rolling stone, and it's bred in the bone. He's a man who won't fit in." Roger eyed each of us as we all sat silently. Finally, Hinkle broke our hush with, "How many jelly beans for tomorrow?" I croaked out a cold, "Only three!" Day four's blizzard seemed to contain a different wind. It was hard to tell just what it meant, but the probability was that it spoke of an improvement, especially if the wind shifted toward the north. Along with the storm, our hearts tournament raged until noon, when the midday meal took priority. As heroic leader, it was my job to cut the three jelly beans into five equal pieces. The tent rule was simple. The cutter chose last, and the others selected their piece according to their heart score. If I screwed up and cut a little sliver, that would be my meal for the day. I pondered the math of dividing three odd-shaped objects into five equal pieces for as long as my hungry companions would allow, then bent to the task under close scrutiny. It wasn't perfect, but closer than expected, and cut complete, we chowed down. We joked that success was assured, it was only survival that was in question. In spite of all our jokes and good-natured banter, the tension in our crowded tent was palpable. At the end of the day, Rob announced that he was going out to sleep in a nearby crevasse so that everybody could have more room. I checked his spot. It seemed safe enough, and Rob assured me that he could stay warm. We organized our messy tent to expedite an early start in the morning, then slid into the old holes that our body heat had created over the last 4 days. Uncomfortable, cold, and turning, I listened for my mind music, but it just thumped out a simple monotone: climb through or die. I knew that, unlike tennis, we could not double fault and still be in the game. We indeed had a universe to think about up here, but it was simple, like the first Flatiron. Day 5, June 24, dawned with a little bit of hope, since the storm was now simply swirling instead of blasting. I checked on Rob and saw him sleeping in his hole, burrowed in his bag. Later, he crawled back into the tent, admitting that he had been cold. It was still far from summit weather, but nearing desperation, we got ready to climb anyway. The clouds would occasionally allow a peek at the sky overhead, but to my dismay, I only saw a layer of high cirrus. Was another storm forming below this before this one cleared? Barb produced our sacred stash of ham that would give us a blast of calories for our summit climbs. We nibbled the ham while we packed our remaining supplies. After the jelly beans, it tasted anomalous. It took 2 hours to extract our frozen tent from its prison. Then we started up into the fog at 7:30 a.m. Coo! As I crunched up the simple slope, I reviewed my summit starts on Denali in 1963, Lucania and Steele in 1967, Logan in 1973, and Four Acre in 1975. They had all been in clear weather and fueled by fiery passions. Here, in 1977, hungry and humble, fueled by a now distant need to regenerate my Everest karma, I stepped up into a broom toward an unknown denouement. There would be no sprints today. We had vital work to do, and we all felt quite dissipated from our 4 storm days with little food. Hoping for solid, wind-swept snow on the upper ridge, we had started without putting on our snowshoes. As I led into a viewless silver sphere, I struggled to get some heat and rhythm into my steps. Slowing in occasional pockets filled with drift snow, I noticed a feeling of weakness in my legs. This was not time for a fist pump, just persistence. Thinking only of the next step, my mind music accepted that this summit climb would start with an adagio. When warmth finally found my muscles, I felt the snow firming as the slope angle relented. I looked up. My white globe was now flecked with blue. A minute later, my new blue orb was flecked with white. 20 steps later, I saw the rounded east summit a few hundred yards ahead, framed by the real world. The storm was over, and without breaking pace, I marched onto the flat summit of Blackburn's East Peak. There were no whoops and shouts this morning. We were all stunned by the sudden views and congregated silently. Our somber, silent summit embrace was sufficient. No one had been here since Dora Keene and George Handy in 1912, a span of 65 years. We took a few extra steps to the north and posed for photos in front of the great peaks of the Wrangell Mountains. I immediately recognized Mount Wrangell, where I spent the summer of 1964. We did not linger long on this summit, and our moments there were just a breath in our adagio. The open view reminded us harshly about how tenuous our position was. We could not see civilization, and the summits were our world. Turning, we started the 2-mile traverse toward our still elusive goal, the West Peak. To better parse our limited energy, we took turns leading. Hinkle led our downhill trek toward a 15,750-foot saddle between the East Peak and a small 15,926-foot summit that lived on the plateau between the East and West Peaks. Blackburn seemed to have an unlimited supply of false summits for us. The lower we went, the softer the snow became, and after slowing and struggling, we stopped to put on our snowshoes. Plodding on, I tried not to calculate how long the traverse was going to take. The traverse, while technically easy, held soft snow, that pesky fault summit, crevasses, and I even spotted the track from an avalanche that had started just below the West Peak. Trudging toward the fault summit, Hinkle shouted, "Stop! Listen!" It took a few seconds to quiet our heavy breathing, then we all heard it. It was the faint purr of a plane. We had forgotten about the outside world, but the world had not forgotten about us. We were now a full week overdue. Phones had been ringing, and when the weather cleared, Wilson's pilots were in the air looking for us. However, they were looking in the wrong place. The plane was far below us. The noise was both comforting and a break in our summit concentration. We had no radios for communication with any plane, and just kept stomping toward our evasive goal. However, the sound became seductively louder. They were circling up our route looking for us. Our position was near or beyond the ceiling for most light planes. Would they make the summit and find us, or just report us missing? Suddenly, it was not so simple. If they did fly over, what would we do? Would we just wave, then continue our lonely struggle? Or would we stomp a message in the snow? What would we say? We didn't really believe that the plane would find us and kept walking, but the purr became a patter, then the roar of a straining engine. Abruptly, the plane that had delivered our airdrop appeared behind us. They had us! Hunger won. After a few shouted commands, we dropped our packs, each took a letter, and all sprinted off our trail to stomp our message. Running in the thin air, we created our mournful memo in 30 seconds. It read simply, "Food." The pilot wagged his wings, then quickly rolled over the ridge toward lower elevations. After huffing from our effort, we hefted our packs and continued toward the West Peak. What had just happened? Before we could process the impact, a second plane appeared. A bit spastic this time, we hustled to create PU-26 to signal a pickup on the Dubesna Glacier for June 26, just 2 days later. The plane flew over before we could complete the two, and it looked like a backward C. Would they get it, or had we created a confusion? Back in motion, we heard a third plane, but I recognized the sound of this engine. It was Wilson's Super Cub. Skipping a further message, we just waved as Jack made a single pass overhead, wagging his wings. I could almost hear Jack muttering, "Can't believe that he's still at it." Jack was obviously still at it, and he clearly cared about us. After all the commotion, it took a while to refocus our rhythm. The difference now was that we had a deadline. We had spent a month getting up this mountain and had just committed to going down it in a day. All we needed was a summit and food. We tromped on. Pulling past the 1,596-foot sub-summit, we found more wind-swept slopes and had to stop to put our crampons back on. We passed the fault summit without incident. Hopefully it was our last faulty. Descending again, we found soft snow in the long 15,850-foot saddle between the sub-summit and the West Peak, the only peak that we had left. Post-holing anew, we had to put our snowshoes back on as the clock ticked. This was now beyond simple ridiculosity, but we had no choice and started uphill toward the West Peak. I took over the lead. Head down, I was finally climbing the peak that I had set out to climb a month earlier. Not pushing, not punching, not pounding, my steps finally found my old music. I set aside my crevasse, cornices, and South Col politics. It was just me and the mountain again, and my directive was simple. Climb! My adagio accelerated to an andante. Just then we hit hard snow and had to put our crampons back on. Tick, tick, tick. Assuming that success is assured and actually achieving success are two different elements. One is in the mind and the other is in the feet. Like all slopes on this mountain, Blackburn's summit slope was longer and steeper than expected. I quietly stepped toward the sky. Just as I anticipated crowning over onto the summit plateau, I heard a plane. What was this? Another flyby? Another wave? Another message? Another interruption? I was only trying to make an ascent here. Could I please climb this mountain? The plane swooped low over the summit. Accelerating to an allegretto, I tried to crest the slope to see what was happening on the summit. Then I saw a package fly out of the plane. We had taken so long to make the traverse that the pilots had time to return to Glen Allen, go shopping, reload their plane, and fly back up to drop us some food. Unbelievably, food had arrived on the summit before us. Now, in a near frenzy, I tried to accelerate it to an allegro, but the tight rope behind me told me that my teammates did not share my need for speed. The plane made several passes over the summit, and I saw several other dots fly free. Where the precious packages landed, I knew not. If I could only get there, I could find them. Would this mountain ever end? My approach to Blackburn Summit was not a triumphal march. If not Byzantine, it was at least bizarre. By the time I crested the summit slope and gazed across the summit flat, the plane was gone. I didn't even get to wave my appreciation. While I had been struggling to reach the summit of one of Alaska's great peaks, a plane was dropping life-giving food, and I couldn't even get there in time to see where it fell. My walk to Blackburn's high point resembled a drunk's. I walked over to a crater, plucked a box from it, walked over there, plucked another box, and arrived at the high point clutching more food than I could eat or even carry. Determined to cling to some semblance of a normal summiting, we set the food aside, and Barb snapped a photo of Rob and I posing on the high point with flags that another party had placed there. Other than the planes flying over and their boxes, the flags were the first sign of another human that we had touched since leaving the gravel bar at Nugget Creek below the Kuskalana Glacier. We didn't have any flags of our own to add. After we assembled on the summit, we snapped a few more perfunctory photos, then scurried around the summit area extracting food boxes from their craters. When we piled all our food together next to the summit flags, I realized that we weren't just saved, we were overwhelmed. We couldn't possibly add this much food to our packs for the descent. Therefore, we had better eat some of it right now. I ripped open a box and looked for a suitable snack. Amazingly, I found some fresh grapes and apples, which didn't last long. Looking for a more substantial lunch, the best I could find was a big bag of ham slices. I tore into it, stuffed copious quantities into my mouth, and pretended that I was a starving man. The rich, salty grub almost made me sick, and it definitely made me thirsty. I looked around for a drink, but we had little with us, and there was no liquid in the food drop. As my mouth went dry, I looked at the price tag on the package of ham. It was enormous, and we would have a big bill waiting for us. I looked at our pile of expensive food, added in the hefty delivery cost, and realized that we had just doubled the cost of the expedition. We were saved and broke. Thus the outside world touched my should-be sublime summit. Our day was far from over, and we loaded up as much food as we thought that we could carry until our packs resembled bloated zombies. We piled up all the trash and, as impatient as we were to get going, decided that we needed to burn the trash. Even here, we were trying to save the world. Rob produced some gas, and I produced a lighter. Poof! We had a bonfire on Blackburn's summit. I watched the ashes curl into the breeze and thought that no one should ever know about this. How could our ascent ever be remembered by a summit trash fire? It just wasn't right. After I hefted my 100-pound pack, I realized that its weight was beyond burlesque. I took my pack off, removed a big can of beef chow mein, and added it to the stash of food that we were leaving on Blackburn Summit for the gods to discover, or perhaps some other hungry climbers. I knew that our cash was beyond an offering. It was odious. As clouds boiled up from the south, I took a last look at a price tag, then staggered off to the northwest in our descent route. Now, all we had to do was get down the mountain. Crunching down gentle slopes, our eyes feasted on new northern views, and fresh from our summit lunch, we all felt better. Each step down took us farther from the miasma that had gripped us for the last 3 weeks, and we started cracking jokes again. However, our overstuffed packs bore down on our shoulders. Easy terrain took us down to 14,800 feet, where we ate another salty snack, pitched a comfortable two-tent camp, melted enough snow for gallons of water, and prepared a feast. It had been a lofty day. That evening, we did our homework with the map, trying to understand the rest of the descent route. The northwest ridge broke steep below us and bifurcated into three possible choices lower down. Staring at the map, I tried to resurrect my memory of the ridge that I had seen flying in with Wilson weeks earlier. We had enough food with us now to sit out any storm, but wanted desperately to get down the ridge in the morning. Hydrated, rested, and stuffed, we rose early to prepare for the descent. After yesterday's summit stagger, we knew that we still had more food than we could carry. We could not manage packs that heavy on the steeper terrain below us, so we carefully prepared another cache of heavy, expensive food. Finally in motion, I led down, down, down as the steepness increased ominously below me. At 12,500 feet, I rejected the western of the three ridge choices, since it broke away steeply. At 11,800 feet, I reached a point where the central and eastern ridges bifurcated below me. This was a vital route choice, and I plopped down to munch some lunch and meditate on the decision. After a final peek at the map, I chose the central rib, and we rose to face the steepest part of our descent. Back on steep terrain, I again worried about falls, crevasses, and avalanches. It was hard to jerk my mind back to attention, but we were still high on a dangerous mountain. On the steepest pitches, I backed down, kicking large steps for my teammates. Huffing and sweating from our effort, we felt tired again, but crept down with a pervasive determination. Lower down, we spotted a line of tracks on the glacier below. Someone was there. At the point where our steep ridge met the upper glacier, we found a camp. In it were four Japanese climbers. They had seen us coming and offered us hot tea. It was a wonderful gesture, a momentous moment for us, and we plopped down for tea time. Their English was rudimentary and our Japanese nearly non-existent, but as we explained our adventure with wild, far-flung finger points, their eyes grew wide. Noticing that we had snowshoes, they asked if we had needed them. I replied, "Oh, yes." When the Japanese leader asked me how deep the snow was, I pointed to my mid-chest, which was as high as his head. Their eyes fell. It was then that I noticed that they had no snowshoes, and that their track leading up to this camp was a long series of postholes. As we said our goodbyes, I hoped that our descent track on the mountain above would help them. Perhaps they could find and use our food caches. I never heard how they fared. Happy to have a broken trail to follow, we tackled the series of Japanese postholes without putting on our snowshoes. However, their small upsteps were all facing the wrong way for our descent. We soon abandoned the Japanese torture trail, then renounced our own postholes and put on our snowshoes. Requiring effort to the end, we marched down to the landing zone on the Nabesna Glacier. I dropped my pack into the powder with a satisfying ploosh. Now it was time for whoops and shouts. We had done it. 4 weeks up, 1 day down, and 12 camps. We had traversed Blackburn. Now all we had to do was wait for a plane to fly us out. How long would that take? The next morning brought valley clouds, not planes, and we teased each other by telling stories about how climbers sometimes spend weeks on a glacier waiting for a plane. We spent several hours counting and organizing our still copious food. Along with everything else, I found a big bag of jelly beans and figured that we could wait a month if necessary. Relaxing, I gazed back up at Blackburn, trying to understand. The mountain seemed impossibly huge, and it just gleamed at me with its myriad crevasses looking like incisors from a 50-headed fiend. Nevertheless, I felt a deep satisfaction, but also felt emotionally and physically weary to my core. The plane arrived at 4 a.m. the next morning, and we rushed to load it. After a second flight, only Rob and I were left on the glacier to finish packing our tents. As I dug around the last tent to free it from the snow, I uncovered a small crevasse. I stared into the glacier's icy heart and felt her frigid breath. It was Blackburn's parting kiss for me. As Rob and I flew out, the pilot chose a route around the east side of Mount Sanford. I saw Sanford's unclimbed east ridge heading up into the swirling cloud and felt the tug of a future escapade. I examined all the pitches that I could see and knew instantly that I could lead them. As my eye disappeared up into the mantle, I knew that I could reach whatever summit was up there. Suddenly, I was summit-skipping, and all summits were up there and reachable. I also knew that truth lived in dreams. They didn't just predict the future, they shaped it. My cloud summit might as well be Everest. With my mind finally flying free, we rolled to a stop on the tarmac at Glen Allen. I hopped out to see Hinkle sprinting up to the plane. He grabbed both my shoulders with summit energy, shook me, and trumpeted a triumphant, "What an adventure!" Over at the shack, our somber group embrace spoke volumes. It was over. Blackburn was more than an awesome adventure. The BB-150's sense of family, friendship, and teamwork equaled that of my Archangel climb on Foraker. Barb and I had shared another great summit together. I didn't understand it yet, but the fact that our Blackburn climb had so many difficulties had better prepared me for the Himalayas than some textbook silky smooth success. Blackburn, while not one of North America's 10 highest peaks, was one of her 16ers. This tough trip offered a corniced sixth movement to my ever-growing Northern Mountain Symphony. My first morning back in Boulder, I rose and went for my run. I could barely hobble, but I did it, and my maniacal training continued. On my long runs, I used my climbing muscles to power up the slopes. Then on the downhill, my weakness, I trained myself to get up on my toes, lean forward, and double my speed. Instead of fearing gravity, I worked at becoming one with it. Nearly flying, it became less about being more human. It was just a dance. In August, I ran up Pikes Peak in 2 hours and 37 minutes and won my age group for that ascent. Then, Barb and I moved to Durango in southwest Colorado to take a job as coordinators for the new Outdoor Pursuits program at Fort Lewis College. This allowed me to double the time that I spent outdoors, and my training vaulted to a new level. In late September, I took off by myself and ran the 33-mile Five Trails course up and over the San Juan Mountains in less than 6 hours, a record. In October, I ran forth and back across the Grand Canyon in 9 hours and 15 minutes. By the end of 1977, I had completed way over 200 peak ascents, and just a mountain dancer, I felt ready for any peak. All I had to do was insert the summit of my choosing into the cloud. Stay tuned for Chapter 8, Muldrow Traverse, Denali 1990, from Northern Heights, Climbing North America's Highest Peaks.